Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team. Welcome back to the Predictable Revenue Podcast. I'm your co-host, Colin Stewart. Today, I'm joined by real life Aaron Ross, as opposed to cardboard cutout edition.
Yeah.
And my friend, Daniel Barber. Today, we're going to talk about GDPR, why you should care, what can you do about it, and what does life look like once it comes in May 25th. Now, Daniel, you've got special knowledge about this because you founded a company based on helping other companies implement and comply with GDPR, and that's Datagrail, right?
Correct. Yeah. Go ahead.
Do you want to just give us a little bit on Datagrail just to provide some context of how you came about all this plethora of knowledge you have?
Yeah. So, as we were sort of going through the ideation phase of what we're going to build and, what problem we can solve for folks, it became very clear that in the new regulatory environment that happens, May 25th, and of course there's e-privacy after that, and there's, large number of regulatory changes that are happening in privacy, it became clear companies had sort of spent resources making sure their product, so if they were a SaaS provider, their product was likely compliant. So they've spent a lot of information saying, we are compliant. And so that's great. That's really, really good. But what was sort of left behind, no pun intended, was the sales and marketing teams that actually act as data controllers. So we'll get into that today, sort of the distinction between a data processor and a data controller and what that means. But, as a data controller, so the explicit terms, what that means, anyone that is housing information on a particular individual. So we use the term today, data subject. Those individuals and that information needs to be provided upon request, either through what's called a data subject request or a data deletion request. And so, given that, sales and marketing teams are now using 50, 100, hopefully not 1,000 different applications, getting that information out of those respective systems is actually very challenging. So we've built a technology to connect to all of those different systems and retrieve and provide deletion, propagation across those respective systems. Simultaneously, there's a large number of companies that now provide systems to communicate with customers or potential customers. So think Intercom, Zendesk, Marketo, Outreach, and so on and so forth. And all of those systems need to have a unified preference center. And so we've built two real products, one that will provide integrations to those systems and the other one to unify those consent and provide a preference center that is unified and propagates those requests from data subjects across all systems.
Great. Actually, then Daniel, maybe in simple terms. So first, just in case people aren't familiar with GDPR, which I think because you're here, you probably know something about it, but right, this is the European Union regulations on, data, how you can keep it, how you can get it, how you can use it. But why don't you give us a couple examples of what this means towards, you talk about the systems, controls, processors, if you have people's data, just a couple examples, what this means day to day, like with the multiple explicit consents or...
Yeah.
Just an example of what this means in, sort of like the day-to-day for people.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point, Aaron. So I think, overall, we've had a pretty loose environment for data and specifically personal data for a long time. There's definitely a trend that is happening and GDPR is one of the catalysts. This other little company called Facebook, is sort of a large catalyst. People are having increased expectations around how their data is used. And if they want it retrieved or if they want to, understand how a company is using their data, that is now sort of becoming an expectation. But more explicitly, GDPR, so the General Data Protection Regulation, comes into place May 25th. So in just a couple of weeks here. And so what that means is companies now need to assess at a high level, first, Are they a data processor or are they a data controller? And the associated sort of points on a day-to-day, that will change the way we communicate to people that are consented. So marketers, if there are marketers on the call, obviously, I'm sure you're aware at this point, you know, there are steps you need to take to ensure that you maintain and operate that consent in a compliant fashion. And then for folks that are doing outbound, there are now stipulations for that as well. So this particular piece of regulation does only apply to EU residents. But, you know, you can assume if you are a US company and you've had, you know, you've got more than 100 employees, you're probably, you have some individuals in your database or you aspire to have some individuals in your database that are in the EU. So if you're trying to contact companies in the European Union or establish customers there, this, you know, this will apply to you. And so for outbound specifically, if you're trying to do that, there are now explicit guidelines of what needs to be provided and when. And that really pertains to an individual's personal data. So what personal data do you have on them? And that's probably a point we can touch on related to the common knowledge of PII. So I think everyone probably knows PII, personally identifiable information. That's an email, that's a name, and so on. That is expanded significantly with GDPR. And so by expanded, any information, even if it is public, is now protected. So if you have the title of someone, so the title of someone may actually indicate exactly who that is, right? So if you have the CEO of, let's say, SAP, well, we could probably do a very simple Google search and find out who that is, right? The IP address of where that person came in is also protected information. You know, the communications between two people is protected information. So all of that is now an expansion of PII, the general understanding that we probably all had to some extent to today.
So, okay, that's a good, great question. For example, so let's switch towards things related to outbound. I know this is where a lot of people have questions. I will say there's a lot of articles online that people have written about general understanding of GDPR. It can get a little complicated, but the reality is, for example, let's talk about list building, right? You are not allowed to buy. How does GDPR change list? If you're going to do, you know, outbound prospecting, whether by email, phone, otherwise, how does GDPR at least change list building? Because you can't buy lists anymore. Correct?
Yeah. So that's a really good question. And one that we actually have a testimonial video coming out from Gunderson, who are the leading sort of startup legal firm and late stage legal firm coming out next week. So look forward to sharing that as a follow up from this. But you know, specifically sort of answering that question, there are new regulations that, you know, companies would need to adhere to do that, to do outbound and to do list building. You know, to give a very specific example, ZoomInfo, who I'm sure many of us are familiar with, they actually stopped their EU data set as of May 4th. So they will no longer be maintaining their EU data set. This is something that we should see and expect from other providers providing data in the EU. And that's largely because the expectation that is now put on those providers is that they must provide explicitly where that information was collected from. So, and as companies, as you know, as salespeople, we also need to explicitly communicate where that data was from in a disclosure to these people that we intend to contact within 30 days. So if your ZoomInfo, as an example, they were collecting their data from people's signatures. So they were sourcing their email addresses and phone numbers from people's signatures, and they were using a plugin that would then pull that information from your inbox. That would be extremely challenging for them to provide that information in an explicit fashion, and is likely not compliant. So ZoomInfo is no more in the EU. And you can continue to use their service in the EU. So that is possible. They will not be maintaining that data set, but that is possible. But that comes with a huge caveat of if you continue to do so, you actually take on full legal responsibility in doing so. And so the fines or penalties for non-compliance are up to 4% of revenue or $20 million. And it's whichever is greater. So that's probably not something that folks would like to see.
Sorry, whichever is greater. So it's a minimum mm-hmm. 20, you said minimum $20 million fine then.
Yeah.
Or if it's more than that, 4% of your revenue.
Correct.
Just making sure I heard that correctly.
Yeah. Yeah. That up to, so, you know, there are sliding scales there, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
So going into this, this list building piece, so buying from ZoomInfo or anybody else like that off the table. So do I just stop prospecting to the EU or what can I do now?
Does anyone have a tactic, if, for example, that you feel would be compliant at this point?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I actually just got off a call with a very well-known high growth startup 20 minutes ago that basically just asked that question. So I can provide the same response. I don't think there are any providers out there that could explicitly say, yes, we are compliant with the regulation. So I can't provide any companies that would state that. But what I would say is that as you're using list, you know, providers or data providers, the number one sort of requirement is that you must explicitly state in a disclosure statement within 30 days where you got that information from. So that needs to be provided either over the phone if you've called them or if you've sent them an email. That is a requirement. And again, we're talking about folks here that are, in the outbound motion. So the inbound motion, and there's a whole nother set of expectations. But for specifically outbound folks who you don't have consent, there are explicit things that need to be provided there. Which is the disclosure statement.
Okay. And is that 30 days from collecting the data or is that 30 days from making first contact?
Communicating with the person.
Okay. So it could be, you could send them your regular 5-step sequence over 29 days. And then on the 30th day, you could send the disclosure in theory.
In theory, yes.
This is not legal advice, but I would advise that you provide the disclosure in advance of putting someone in a 7 to 10 step sequence. Simply because, at the after point of that sequence, they haven't really had a choice in whether they receive that message. If you put them in the sequence and then provide the disclosure, you're likely to irritate someone, which again, this is the goal here, at least from a GDPR perspective, is to provide better rights for data subjects. And so providing that disclosure, this is where I got the information from at the top of the email. This is where it's being collected from. We'd like to engage with you. And then we proceed.
Yeah, because I know, first of all, a lot of people don't really know because there's parts of the law that are vague. But I know I was reading some article that they said, if you send a targeted, so one, different people, some people think you can't send a targeted email, period. Someone else said, if it's targeted and relevant to you and to them, and you have like a real case for it. I think the example they used was you saw someone had written an article about social media, and in there there's something they've said that is related to the business you want to offer to them, right? So there's like a real case for their interest. And really they could send one email if they don't get a response, and you can't send any more if you want to be compliant. So I don't know.
Yeah. So so to be very explicit around how that works, there's the inbound motion is all about consent, which we can get into as well, which is certainly an important topic, but, specific to this area around outbound, there's this concept of legitimate interest. And so legitimate interest is exactly what you're talking about, Aaron. If you've seen someone on a forum mention that you know, they are looking for this or they have a problem in this area and you feel like your services or technology could assist in removing that problem for them, that is a basis for legitimate interest. The concept around legitimate interest, there will be more detail coming soon. So it is a little gray, but there will be what's called a legitimate interest balancing test. And so that will start to provide clear definition of, if you've seen it on a forum that someone is looking for this, or you expect that they, you know, likely are going to be facing a challenge that your company could help solve, then you can contact them in an outbound capacity. But if you just are buying a large list and sending them emails, you're going to get in, that'll be not compliant. Let's put it that way.
Yep. Well, again, it'll be interesting to see how all this shakes out in the day to day, because I think everyone's mostly taking a guess, is my impression.
Yes. Yes. I think, you know, there's the outbound piece is quite challenging. It's definitely an area, you know, we did a webinar with Sales Hacker towards the end of February, and we had, you know, 500 registrants on that webinar. It's definitely the number one thing people are concerned about, understandably so, because we've seen outbound prospecting become a motion that people are very comfortable doing. And can thank you for Aaron for that sort of seed that was planted. I myself have done that activity, but I think in the EU this is there's just increased sort of expectations around what data you have on a particular individual and just where you've collected it from. This opens up a whole set of technology and services that are sort of required to make sure that data subjects, people, know where their information has come from.
Yep, hence like DataGrail. Okay, so here's the question. So I think it's a good one. For example, if you know this, right? We'll see here. If let's say that you guess at their email address, you know that it, AB.com, and if it's first name, last name. If you write an email, hey, I saw you post here, by the way, I got your email by guessing at it, right? As long as you're disclosing where you got it, that's what they're asking for. That would be.
Yes. So we had an example yesterday with a company going through the exact same example you just gave. So presumably you've gone to their LinkedIn profile and you've seen that this is a person. And then you've got their first name and last name, which again, in the old standard of PII, that would not have been PII. That's a first name and last name. That's not personally identifiable information. But in the expansion of GDPR around personal data, that now is, right? Because even though it's publicly available with the first name and last name, I can then put your email address together by exactly as you described, guessing the email address. And so, yes, in the disclosure statement at the top of the email, you would need to state, I found your information on LinkedIn. I guessed your email, and so some structure there. You disclose that you've taken that process, and then you can continue contacting them. But if they make the request that they don't want to be contacted, then you need some way of tagging that individual. So a unified sort of preference center to say, yep, we can't contact this person anymore. That also means that you can't market to them. So this has pretty large ramifications for marketing teams, right? So if you receive that response from someone to say, yep, please don't contact me, you can't then, consent them through the traditional means of maybe in Marketo or HubSpot and then just continue to contact them. They need to be blacklisted in some capacity.
Yep.
Gotcha. Just to go back to the top of this, we found them on LinkedIn. We found them on LinkedIn. We guessed their email. We told them that, but we also need to have that's not the only two pieces. We don't just need to disclose that. We also need to have a reason documented somewhere as to the legitimate business interest.
Correct. Correct.
So can you give me, do you have any examples? And I know this is a super gray area, but do you have any examples of what might be or might not be legitimate interest?
Yeah, that's probably an area I can't provide context to yet, mainly because we don't have it from the regulation. We have a searchable version on datagrail.io that you can search anything you want there. But that specific point around the balancing test, i.e. the legitimate interest balancing test has not been clearly stated by current regulators. So I don't have context there yet. Yes.
There's very similar regulations and very similar language in CASEL, the Canadian anti-spam legislation. And it took them years to come up with more sort of clarity around that idea. And it's still not great.
Yeah. I think existing regulation, CASEL is interesting because there's definitely some connections there. I think what we're going to see with GDPR is that this actually does have teeth. What we saw with, you know, the CAN spam and CASEL sort of regulation, never really any fallout from. Yeah, exactly. You know, if you look at any updates from the ICOs, so the Information Commission Office from the UK, they have staffed up. So they have people ready by the phone to take these complaints. They have legal teams assembled. And so I think, you know, we will see at least requests come in and be processed for people that are upset with how they've been marketed to. Especially in countries like Germany and France, where there's particular sort of friction there in the way that companies may try to do business with those countries. I wouldn't be surprised we'll start to see a decent number of requests and penalties issued to companies who are really stretching the line with how they communicate to individuals in the EU.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to leave the impression that CASEL hasn't had teeth. There have definitely been many fines, you know, upwards of, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. I know there's a couple of fines that have been hit with, you know, 7-figure fines. So it's not like CASEL isn't being enforced.
No. Yeah.
I do want to go back to a previous comment. You said something about you did a webinar with Sales Hacker. Now, let's pretend that I imagine there are some people from the EU in there. Let's pretend you wanted to sell Data Grail to them. Now you're a third party. It was Sales Hacker's webinar. Could you then reach out to them? Is that legitimate? You know, in your opinion, would that be legitimate interest?
It's a really good question and a tactical one. So, so in the case of the Sales Hacker webinar, the disclosure has to be stated from Sales Hacker. So they are a customer of Data Grail, which is great. But they have to disclose on their form when people consented to receive messages from from Sales Hacker. They need to disclose that this information will be shared with Data Grail in order for us to contact them in a consented fashion. Otherwise, their information is now being shared in a legitimate interest fashion. And if it is shared in a legitimate interest fashion, so they could share the list per se with Data Grail and with us. But if we obtain that, we now need to disclose where we got that information from. And that may put Sales Hacker at risk. So that's not likely something that they would want to do unless they've disclosed very clearly on the form that right below the explicit box, your information will be shared with the sponsored host.
Gotcha. Thanks for that. Because there's, I think, two really important pieces there just in terms of like people that are approaching these joint webinars and making sure that they're staying compliant. Because the last thing you want to do is to not think about this, do a joint webinar, get it afterwards, and then get the sponsoring party in trouble.
Yeah. So I won't name the name, but they are a leading sales and marketing consultancy in the Bay Area. They ran an event earlier in the year. I attended the event and my name and information was shared with all vendors. And now I am in the opt-in list for all vendors and receiving marketing communications. So HubSpot emails from all of the vendors, and there's about 10 of them that are now sending me emails. Yeah, that's going to get you in a lot of trouble on both sides. So the person that's actually sending the quote unquote opted in message and the consultancy that, leading consultancy, that's going to get them in trouble. So the traditional model of, yes, attend a webinar, get the list, start emailing them. You got to take some steps there to make sure you're in compliance. This is pretty logical, right? I mean, I, as an individual, receiving 10 different emails from 10 different vendors, and then I get put in sequences. I mean, that's not a nice experience, right? Yeah.
That seems to be pretty common at conferences, too.
Yes. Yeah. So conference vendors really need to do a better job there to make sure that they are staying compliant.
Because it applies specifically, like if somebody from the EU comes to that webinar, you're in trouble. But if it's, you know, other Americans, Canadians, not much of an issue necessarily. But if there are any Europeans.
Yeah, which presumably, you know, people travel, right? You know, if they're working for global companies, it's you would expect that there would be one or two or three people from a conference that are from the EU. And you've only got to aggravate one person, and that person will file a complaint with the ICO, and you're not in a great place after that.
Doesn't sound like a pleasant experience. Let's all do our best to avoid this.
Yeah, I think, you know, taking a slightly positive spin on it, I mean, I think this is, if you think about it as a customer, and sort of this is something that we stand by, is that, you know, it's sort of an expectation at this point. If I go to a service provider and I say, hey, I actually don't want to do service with you anymore. I want my data deleted, or at least I want to know what you have on me, and therefore please delete that out of your systems. And I kind of want proof that you did that. It's good for the customer in that aspect of, you know, providing transparency into what data someone has. And today, if you think about it, as you maybe opt out from someone's communications, they're still going to sell your data, right? And that's not really a great company thing. That's not providing transparency to the customer. So I think from a positive lens, it does provide increased transparency for people and how their data is being used, which is ultimately a good thing. But it does create a friction point, which I think we're all experiencing at this stage.
That's fair.
Yep.
Hey, I've got one or two more questions here, and then we're going to go to the participants, everybody that's live. So anybody that's listening in, there's a Q&A button at the bottom. Obviously, if you're listening to the podcast, no Q&A button, sorry. But jump in there, and this is your opportunity. Ask any of those questions, and we're going to hammer through them. We're going to take about, you know, the next 2 minutes, 2 to 5 minutes, and try and get through those. So get your questions in now. We'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Somebody like we've had a lot of conversations about how do you prospect to the EU, right? You know, obviously email has gotten a lot harder. The phone, you still need to disclose. What about LinkedIn?
That's sort of just it's, social media in general, like Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn,
other channels.
Just reaching out on, can you send someone a message on social media? Can you leave them a comment on their post?
Yeah, I mean, so LinkedIn has updated their terms of service. You've probably seen a million different privacy policy updates in your inbox over the last, 2 to 3 months. We've been collecting all those because we're going to do an explosive blog post on that topic. But yeah, I mean, it's still a form of outreach, right? So I think you are going to see an increased number of people using LinkedIn as a channel to do so. I think that's probably going to put them in a bit of a tough spot. They have updated their terms of service. And so, in accordance with that, they've been very explicit about what they can and what they cannot do. So I would, from a legal standpoint, if you intend to increase the amount of outreach that you're doing on LinkedIn, definitely consult their terms of service before you do so. In leaving comments and so forth, I think that's fine. Again, not legal counsel, but I think you're fine there. Same with Twitter. They have been very outward about updating their terms of service, updating their privacy policy. If you intend to use DMs for that process, so direct messages on Twitter, the courtesy, the benefit of Twitter is that you have to get someone to follow you back first. So I think that's probably a strong indication of legitimate interest. I think you likely should be fine there. And, you know, if you acquire their information from the data subject in that means, and then you go and contact them, you just need to be clear that, yep, I acquired your information. So disclosure statement, I acquired your information from our message on Twitter. And that's why I'm now emailing you.
Mm-hmm. What about LinkedIn emails when you aren't connected? Because like I understand if you're already connected, that's sort of the legitimate interest piece. They've similar to Twitter, you know, you've connected with them. They've accepted the connection request. There's got to be sort of like a two-way street that you've almost implied consent, but not necessarily expressed consent. But would emails when you haven't connected with somebody first, do you know, have an idea of where that might sit, or is it still gray area?
It's not. I mean, so when you've, so for folks that have adopted their new terms of service, which again, those were prompted to you as you logged into LinkedIn. So I don't know if you, many of the users on the phone may notice that when you log into LinkedIn, or at least in the last, I would say 72 hours, the big pop-up that says we've updated our terms of service. There's no option there to actually say no. You have to accept the terms of service. So I think you're going to be okay. I would say that particular medium is going to face some challenges because, you know, if you think about it, when you send that email, that actually, assuming they have the settings set up that way, it's going to send the person an email. So there's a byproduct of when they receive that email, it's going as an email. So while it is another channel, it's still resulting in an email. So I would say, you know, from a high level, it's hard to say how that's going to play out, but I would imagine there's going to be increased pressure from LinkedIn to probably adjust the terms of service again, because people will move to LinkedIn being that they can't send over email, or can't call. So they'll use another medium to do so, but that will pose its own problems.
Mm-hmm. I imagine we'll see that evolve as, you know, once things come into effect.
Exactly.
If LinkedIn users are buying in-mail credits and then getting hit with $1 million fines, I don't imagine people are going to be too happy. That's not going to happen too many times before LinkedIn says,
no,
you know what? Fine. You can't send in-mails anymore to people in the.
Yeah.
Cool. Your comment just a few minutes ago, you mentioned that they can't make phone calls or can't send emails. Do you mean it like they shouldn't at all, or just it's much harder now?
There's just the disclosure statement, right? So there's that legitimate interest balancing test that we're going to have more context for in the coming weeks. And then when they do that, they need to disclose where the data came from. I think, you know, for companies like ZoomInfo that have provided direct dial information, the reason why that disclosure statement becomes so challenging is that, you know, if you disclose, well, the data has come from ZoomInfo, well, then if the data subject is upset with that response, they can take it to ZoomInfo, and then ZoomInfo would have to disclose which particular user's inbox that they were able to get access to and pull the signature data from. Who provided that? So they've terminated their data set for those reasons. It's very challenging to then expose where exactly that data came from.
Right, the origin.
Gotcha. So if you're
exactly
if you're the originator, if you're able to say find it somewhere, or even guess it, like we talked about earlier, and you have that legitimate interest, then in that context,
and you've disclosed it,
and you disclose it,
you can then continue.
You can continue. What about with for maybe people that I previously engaged with? Like, let's say I ran a bunch of campaigns last year, and I had you know, a number of people that said, you know what, timing's not great now, but contact me May 26th, 2018, just to be cheeky.
Yeah, I mean, there is this sort of you know, line in the sand around, are they consented contacts? Because if they're consented contacts, meaning that they gave their explicit, well, hopefully explicit consent. So explicit consent, meaning there was an unchecked checkbox and the person checked the checkbox and then said, yes, please contact me. That, and you captured when you did that, the IP address and all of that information, you can continue to send marketing messages. If you had someone that was someone you just had a sales conversation with a year ago and they said, reach out to me, May 26th, you know, I would advise still providing that disclosure statement. Mm-hmm. Just because there's a risk remediation piece that you're going through here, right? You know, that it really comes down to, are you going to irritate the data subject? And you know, the better you can just be transparent about where the information came from, and you know, that disclosure, the more likely that you're not going to have problems. So just being transparent with the person you're intending to contact is a really good start. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. What about for contacts that have already opted in to our list? So let's say we run a mail, we've got a mail, big MailChimp list. Half of them are in the EU. What's the call there? Does it depend on the checkbox on whether it was unchecked or checked?
It depends. Yeah, it depends on quite a few things. So this is the area that, you know, we're as Datagram most focused on, because you know, the consent process that happened at the time of when they consented is really the most important piece. So if they didn't check an unchecked checkbox, so they didn't provide explicit consent, you know, technically you can't continue to mail and send emails through MailChimp using your example post May 25th unless you've received that opt-in from a technical standpoint. That's the legal definition. Now, you know, again, there, of course, there's risk associated if you continue to email them. But I'm sure folks have seen on the line, and I'm sure the two of you have seen folks, there are companies trying to re-opt in their users. If you've received those messages and you're in the US, that means that clearly they didn't delineate between EU users and US users. They just sent the message to everyone, which is really unfortunate. Mm-hmm. So, you know, ideally the first step would be to understand, or at least try to understand where your users are from. And that IP address is probably a good start. So hopefully you collected that. And then, you know, notifying them, you know, in order for you to continue receiving messages from us, we need you to re-opt in. And that would be the lowest risk process to ensure that you can continue to contact them through marketing automation.
Gotcha. Do programs like MailChimp, Marketo, Eloqua, Pardot, do they track these, the IP by default?
They do, but they may not track whether someone provided an explicit opt-in. And so that's where the tagging and processing of all of your data, meaning making sure that it adheres to the appropriate standards, this, where it originated from, right? So how did you get that message? Were they put into the MailChimp list because you met them at an event? And then using that example earlier, right? Like how did you get those? Mm-hmm. They don't provide that part. So there is kind of a missing gap there, which is where we sort of fit in. Because they're, as you can probably imagine, people have got now a large list. They need to make sure that they're tagged. The origin of where the lead came from is tagged. The consent is tagged, the IP address is tagged, the privacy policy that they adhered to at the time of when they opted in is tagged. And if they opt out, let's say through a sales loft message or an outreach message, that then propagates through to the other systems so they don't just keep getting messages from marketing automation, because that'll put you in a black hole really fast. Hmm.
Okay, perfect. I want to just shift gears, and we get a couple more questions and then we'll wrap it up here. Yeah. So let's say, going back to that example where we're putting them into a cold sequence. We have an idea of, okay, we're disclosing this is where we got your information.
Got the data from.
Yeah, this is where we got the data from. This is the sort of reason why we feel like it's a legitimate business interest. And we disclose that in the first email, but they don't respond.
Yep.
Can we still reach out to them? Do we need to have that disclosure in every single email?
That's a good question. If they don't respond, I mean, again, it's going to be a risk-based approach here. So depends on how much risk you want to tie to the business. You know, I think disclosing where you got the data from for all future messages, if you don't get a response, is probably a good idea. And maybe adjusting sequences accordingly. So at least there's a disclosure of where this data came from. and the specific origin, not, you know, I got it from ZoomInfo. Well, what does that mean? So going back to your data vendors and asking them, how are they getting this information? Right. So understanding how they get it is very important. And that I think we've seen a lot of companies, you know, proactively issue data processing agreements and understand from their data vendors, where are you getting this stuff from? So, you know, disclosing that in all future messages is probably not a bad idea from a risk remediation standpoint. Mm-hmm. If they you don't get a response from the person, I mean, we know in sales it probably takes 5 or 6 or 7 responses, right? So mm-hmm. you probably want to continue. But if you do get, you need to clearly have an opt out or a link that can take them to a centralized place that says, okay, these are the things I want to receive. These are things I don't want to receive. Because if you've just got a message for that and they opt out from your outreach sequence or your sales off sequence, and then for some reason they get in an events marketing list and they get a message from Pardot or Marketo, you're going to get a complaint for sure.
Okay. So I think the trick here is making sure that we're honoring those opt-outs, not just within the cadence, but across
the company,
all systems. Yeah.
The entire company.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, that's what your company helps people do. Wow. Well, I was wondering how you knew all this.
Well, it's funny, right? I mean, I think Aaron, you and I have been doing this for sort of the last decade, and you've been doing this longer than I have. You see how this all plays out. You know, working for an email service provider myself, I definitely learned some areas of expertise around that. And then working for companies that are in the sales and marketing technology, it's very clear that there's some gray area around how they collect that information. And there's a lot of companies that are even just aggregating data, right? So there are data providers. If you ask them, where are you getting this stuff from? They're not collecting it just themselves. They're pooling in all of these other data providers and then packaging it for you. That's really messy. And so, you know, if there's one thing that I would say to folks on the line as a takeaway, definitely find out from the data providers you are working with, where are they getting their data from? So, yeah, you're probably setting up a call with that company to ask, where did it originate from? Because I need to know that to disclose it to the people I intend to contact.
Mm-hmm. We've covered quite a few parts of a fairly complicated law. Yeah, and we've gone through most of the questions. Sorry if we didn't get to all of them. But any final thoughts for people, you know, relating to this legislation?
Yeah, so we had one company today, again, high growth startup, that is approaching it from a holistic point of view of, yes, this is in Europe. And yes, as an American company, we could say, well, it's not our problem. It's only for companies in Europe. I would advise folks to think about this as, you know, you're providing a better experience for your customer if you're able to disclose this type of information to anyone. And we're talking with a large number of companies, including the one I just talked to prior to this podcast, where they are treating all of their individuals in one fashion. So they're not trying to segment out these EU folks, because, you know, it's starting with the EU. It's highly likely these disclosures and this information that needs to be pulled back will follow everywhere. Strava, as an example, they're a B2C company, and so they're applying regulation and sort of data access across all users. Because if you're a user and you want to remove your data from their system, they're going to adhere that request across whether you're in the EU or you're in the US. So that would be sort of my one takeaway. Is it's very challenging to sort of cut the pie and say, okay, this is the EU user set. And I've seen folks do that and that works. But I would say this is probably a change that's going to continue. So focusing in on just this date is the date I need to have everything in place will only then make it more challenging down the road.
Yeah, gotcha. So to summarize, just hold yourself to the highest standard available. And right now that's GDPR.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. If people want to learn more about GDPR, I know you've got an indexed version and indexed and searchable version of the legislation on your site. We'll add that into the, we're going to send out this recording. We'll send that out in the notes as well. Where else can they find information on the GDPR or get in touch with you if they've got questions?
Yeah, sure. So we're about to do a very exciting launch. In fact, we just had our designer go through that today. So that's coming next week, and we'll have two very informative videos that will help folks. One that's specifically from a lawyer, so someone that's more educated on the space than I am. So that's coming. So excited to share those. Folks can find me on the yellow pages or the white pages of the internet, otherwise known as LinkedIn. I will do my best to respond. As you can probably imagine, the last few days here leading up to May 25th, I'm definitely underwater, so I'll do my best.
It sounds like you've just given explicit consent to everybody here. So
I have. I didn't check a box, but you can contact me there.
It'll be recorded, yeah.
Great. Thanks, Doug. You can find me on Twitter. So Gaijin Dan, if you're curious why Gaijin, I spend some time in Japan, and that's Japanese for foreign person.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on the show, foreign person, Dan Barber.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for joining us, Aaron.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everybody, for joining. We'll see you all next week.